I'm Matchmaker Maria, the founder of Agape Match. For over a decade, I've combined four generations of family matchmaking tradition with modern relationship psychology, behavioral science, and dating trends. With this unique expertise, I answer your dating and relationship questions and interview experts to give you the tools to find or keep the love of your life. This is Ask a Matchmaker. Welcome to the Ask a Matchmaker podcast. I'm your host, Matchmaker Maria, and do I have a guest for you this week? I've invited Chris Rackliffe, or you can find him online at Cracklife, C-R-A-C-K-L-I-F-F-E, as he is fondly known online on the internet. He is a trauma healer and a mental health advocate and an anxious attachment style coach and the author of the self-help book, It's Good to See Me Again, How to Find Your Way When You Feel Lost, a guidebook on the journey to emotional healing. Chris, welcome to the Ask a Matchmaker podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Maria.
And this is a hotline episode, so we'll be taking questions at the end of this at the end of our little talk.
Great.
Because we want to hear from you, your questions, and get you those answers because, oh my gosh, we have an anxious attachment coach. Like, what is that? Tell me more about this.
Let's help as many people as possible because attachment theory is one of those things that changed my life.
Sure.
Finding out that the trauma that I had been through was kind of playing itself out in my adult relationships and that I had an anxious attachment style was a game changer for me. Sort of one of those watershed moments, like, wow, like a light bulb goes off and you just realize, wow, I've been behaving this way because I had a lot of instability growing up.
And tell me more about that.
So just to kind of give you the Cliff Notes version, I mean, my parents divorced when I was 2 years old. I was sexually abused by my own middle sister at 5 years old. At 8 years old, my mom moved really far away with her then second husband. And so that was kind
of— Your dad was raising you?
My dad was raising me. And that was kind of an abandonment wound, you know, where a caregiver, my mom, someone that I adored, moved so far away. And it's confusing to an 8 year old, you know? So I went from seeing her like 2 to 3 times a month to 2 to 3 times a year. And that was shocking to my 8 year old brain. I didn't understand that she had remarried and her second husband got a new job. And so I was in this tension really for 10 years from the age of 8 years old to 18 of going to visit her and just pining after her. And that really kind of defines the anxious attachment style, this longing, this pining, this scheming almost to try to see someone, to try to bridge that gap. Anxious attachers are very leaned in mm-hmm. by nature to their relationships. They'll do anything to try to make it work because they're deeply afraid of abandonment.
And it seems like acknowledgement too. Like, are you acknowledging me? Are you, you know, able to identify my own needs? You know, how about, you know, you mentioned the trauma that you experienced with your sister. Was your sister still in the picture between ages 8 and 18?
Yes, she was around throughout my life. It was a memory I had repressed until after our mom passed when I was 18. And she was 9 years older, so she would have been 27 at the time. My mom was an alcoholic, so there was even more instability.
Right.
I ended up in all these long distance relationships throughout my 20s that mirrored that physical distance and in a lot of ways, emotional distance that I felt with her as well. And then my sister also passed from addiction, the same one. And so, you know, I really had to take a step back and look at my choices because throughout my 20s, I was repeating this pattern and just heartbroken, you know?
I assume when you say patterns and what you just described, you're picking partners that were maybe emulating the same feelings of abandonment.
Yes.
Or not giving you enough attention.
Exactly. Yes. I was dating emotionally unavailable partners and also physically unavailable. Oftentimes they were long distance.
Mm.
So we're talking out of state, taking trains, taking flights, like the pining that I told you about. Mm-hmm. These were trauma bonds that recreated the emotional dynamic of distance and unavailability that I felt growing up.
When was your mind blown when you learned about attachment?
Oh my goodness. I mean, at this point, it was almost 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, about the age of 25, I took a step back and realized that the rubber wasn't really meeting the road for me.
Okay.
That I was going on a ton of dates. I had a lot of interest, but no traction. Like, it wouldn't end up in a relationship. And at the time, I was living in New York. I mean, as a gay man, there's plenty of options in New York.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't have an issue meeting people. It was just in the traction of, you know, finding a match that wanted what I wanted. And it seemed like the only time I found it was when they weren't here, when I was visiting or they were visiting. And, you know, I think in a lot of ways that those environments allowed me to let my guard down and also reminded me, of course, emotionally of that distance that I told you about growing up.
Did you feel like even when you were with someone, like they are physically next to you, that you might also initiate conflict just to get that sort of dopamine hit?
What you're talking about is called protest behavior, and anxious attachers engage in this unconsciously without knowing it. They're not aware of it, but they will act out, they'll withdraw, they'll keep score. The biggest trigger that I felt and that I hear about now from my coaching clients who have an anxious attachment style is, I haven't heard back from this person. There's a lack of communication, or usually it's texting. Like, I haven't heard back from them all day. They're not messaging me with the frequency that I want. Mm-hmm. And I felt that too. And that's one of those things that can be a hallmark of anxious attachment. And that oftentimes leads to folks acting out in protest behavior because they're not getting what they want. The thing about protest behavior, though, is that it ends up pushing away the very connection that you're seeking. So you end up then self-sabotaging in a lot of ways.
Chris, you know what I find so interesting about the conversation that we're having is that, you know, I think with my own coaching clients, as a matchmaker, I tend to talk to a lot of anxious women. Right. And yeah, a lot of them maybe didn't start off as anxious. They may have started as people that would be more securely attached,
yep,
but maybe they dated an avoidant partner. In mm-hmm. this case, for a lot of women that maybe listen to this, it might have been a straight man. And when we think of some men, you know, by and large, a lot more men, and I'll say straight men here, mm-hmm. Might be more avoidant than anxious. We also see that there is certainly enmeshment in households where maybe a mother had an overly emotional attachment to her son.
Yes.
She can, or that sort of environment can create an emotional bandwidth that the child, the adult child, can no longer, you know, might not have enough capacity to give more, you know, creating the avoidant man, let's mm-hmm. say, right?
Very well said. Yes.
And I love that I'm hearing now the other side of the coin. You know, you're a man.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, it's not necessarily the emotional, let's call it emotional incest from a parent, where, you know, that could create avoidance.
Yes.
You have a case of emotional immaturity from your mother, creating the foundation for the anxious attachment style that you're experiencing as an adult.
Yes. Remember that every experience we have, every relationship that we have, leaves an impression on us. We learn from that. The brain, and as human beings, we're constantly learning and adjusting and creating impressions about life, about the world, and about relationships in particular.
Right.
So if you go through a string of experiences, maybe you do lose a parent, maybe you do go through several dating experiences or long-term relationships where there is this pining that we're talking about, or the unavailability that creates the pining.
Mm-hmm.
And so your system learns to anticipate your needs are not going to get met as an anxious attacher. And so, yes, this is always developing. And what I love about this is that it means that we're always learning, and it also means that you can always learn a new way.
I 100% agree with you. I feel like even just having the vocabulary, even being able to acknowledge the reality, the past, how that affects our future, I feel like, and I would love to hear from you, like I feel like in my own clients, I do see a rewiring of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see it with your clients? Do you feel like when you specifically, I mean, you seem to coach a specific niche.
Yes.
Do you see the rewiring?
I do. And that's a big part of the work, is right, trying to create these new neural pathways in the brain. And to put it a different way, to kind of write over some of the pain of the past with safe experiences now, One of the very first things that I do for my clients is the day that they sign up to work with me, I give them what I call the daily self-care practice. I'm using air quotes for those listening. Or sometimes I'll refer to it as the daily nervous system regulation practice.
Okay.
And what it does is it helps an anxious attacher to not self-abandon. And that is a core component of being a codependent. And anxious attachers are codependents. Codependency just means self-abandonment.
Right.
This person's needs are ahead of my own because I don't want you to leave me. And so it's not rocket science, but we're talking about stuff like hydration, sleep, moving your body, getting outside, getting some fresh air, going on just a 15-minute walk. I'm not a fitness coach, but you got to move your body. Also, trauma is stored in the body. So nervous system regulation also has to do with not only being present for what you're experiencing right now, and many of us learn to dissociate from our bodies. It's why we go up into the mind and overthink a lot of times. And bringing yourself back into your body through things like meditation and cold exposure, which does the second thing, which builds more of a tolerance for stress in the future. You're literally practicing your body's stress response in that moment by shocking it. Wait, your skin is your body's largest organ.
You're like saying things that I've never heard these words. So, what is cold exposure?
So cold exposure would be like cold plunging, taking a cold shower, dipping your hands in like a mixing bowl or a large bowl of ice water.
Okay.
And what it means is just kind of for 30 seconds, 45 seconds, 60 seconds, as long as you can tolerate that, because it's putting your body in a stress response. The same stress response that you have when you do not hear back from that person all day.
So why is repositioning that stress this way better? Is it because you're controlling the narrative?
It brings you back into your body and creates even just a couple of seconds of awareness so that when you're triggered, you're not acting out in protest behavior. You have enough of a flash to say, I'm triggered. I need to take some time. I need to self-soothe. Mm. And then to approach someone from a more grounded place. Mm. When you're triggered and you're feeling that distance and you want to, say, create conflict out of nowhere, which many anxious attachers do because they want connection at any cost.
But don't you feel like a lot of, I feel like I see this a lot watching, especially shows from the 90s and the early 2000s, but I think these sort of relationship tropes exist from the beginning of time. I mean, you see it also in Greek tragedies and in, mm-hmm. you know, I'm sure Chinese mythology and Indian mythology too. You see like, you know, this cat and mouse, the chasing, right? Like I think about a lot about Sex and the City sometimes, right? Carrie Bradshaw,
Big.
Right? That's like the caricature of an anxious attachment. And 100%. Mr. Big, the caricature of an avoidant attachment style. And I mean, every single plot line in this show is her in protest behavior, as you put it, just, I need acknowledgement, I'm initiating conflict. And him just enjoying the ego stroke that he gets from an anxious person, getting all the positives of his relationship with Carrie is net positive. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not even aware that she has needs that are not being met. And he sees it as a place from independence and not a place from like, let's create a space where we're co-creating together.
Very well said. Very well said. Their relationship in particular is the classic anxious avoidant dance dynamic, right, or relationship. And that dynamic in particular can be really damaging for a lot of people to go through it, because it does oftentimes recreate childhood dynamics. This is where connecting the dots for yourself and where attachment theory can be so powerful, because it is self-informed. It's context-driven.
Right.
It depends on the experiences that you've been through. It's not sort of these platitudes of relationship advice that go out to everyone. It's based on the experiences that you have been through and how you show up in your relationships. And for Carrie, you can see a lot of that protest behavior keeping him at arm's length. And maybe perhaps if I had worked with her or given her this daily self-care practice, she would have been more grounded to approach and to co-create,
because right.
they're both emotionally unavailable just in different ways.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And I think what's frustrating as a viewer is as a viewer, but also as like a person in the dating industry is a few things. Number one, that it should have ended when she was on her way. If you've watched Sex and the City, if you have not, spoiler alert, but also come on. But when she goes to, Russia, when she goes to France with the Russian, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he comes and he's like, I'm ready. No, like the way she ended it, the way she yelled at him, like it's over. End scene. Like, we look at her. She's in her power. Let her be. Like, I was really surprised when they brought him back. I was like, he's still here? And then, of course, in the movie, when he leaves her at the altar, like, I'm like, how are we expecting? But I think what frustrates me more than anything now as a matchmaker and dating coach is that we use Mr. Big, this title, as what we're all looking for. And I'm like, even this weekend, the New York Post wrote an article. It was saying something like how women's standards have become so high that they are not, they're remaining single.
Right.
Which, by the way, I 100% disagree. And in fact, the dating expert that they use, and I hate putting that in quotes, but in this case, this person does not live in New York. She married and moved to Texas.
Okay.
I mean, I don't live in New York either. I live in New Jersey and proud of it. But I'm also here 3 times a week, and almost all my clients live in New York, at least matchmaking.
Yeah.
So I know, I literally set up 1,000 dates a year in New York. Like, I know what the dating landscape is here.
Sure.
But she was saying, and what the Post was saying, is that they're all looking for their Mr. Big. And I was like, who is looking for Mr. Big? Like, how is that the title? I think we're all looking for, like, you know, I like to say Stanley Tucci or, you know,
an Aiden
before he became anxious because Carrie cheated on him when she became a void. Like,
correct.
So it's all threaded here, right? But this is what I'm saying. Like, it's so interesting to me as a pop culture enthusiast to watch the term Mr. Big permeate our American culture as the epitome of the kind of man women are looking for, when I actually think he is the worst example of what a woman should look for, at least from an emotional compatibility side.
Couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
I mean, again, you can see a lot of emotional immaturity on his side of things, certainly.
Terrible.
That's not the goal. The goal is ultimately to have the kind of co-created partnership that you're talking about through tough conversation, certainly uncomfortable moments.
Right.
But not this
Harry
leaving
and Charlotte.
Leaving you at the yes, good,
like,
yeah.
Harry and Charlotte, right there.
Yes.
They co-create everything.
They're
like,
they're secure couple.
Yeah, they are secure.
Yeah.
Oof, I love them.
But you also, and this is an important thing for people to hear, especially on the anxious side of things, you don't just find a secure partner and then everything's great.
Oh no, you got to work on it.
You have to yourself advance along the attachment spectrum to the more secure side of things yourself. And the relationship that you have with your body and with your past is incredibly important. We carry, again, those impressions with us from the past. Perhaps if Carrie had addressed some of her own traumas or previous relationships,
she had a shoe habit. I don't know if she had any more money left for therapy.
Fair enough.
That said, in terms of therapy, how do you feel about taking some questions for the hotline?
Let's do it. Yeah.
All right. Welcome to the Ask a Matchmaker hotline. How can we help you?
Hi, thank you so much for taking my question. I am a cishet woman, and I'm 33. And my current debacle is I feel that I'm very confident. I've done a ton of work in therapy over the years. But when I'm dating and I like someone, my anxious attachment style gets triggered. And the confident person that the guy was originally attracted to kind of gets eclipsed by my younger self's anxious attachment style. And I'm wondering if you have any tips or how I might be able to maintain my sense of self and carry that confident self through from singlehood to while dating.
Incredible question.
Agreed. One of the first things that needs to happen in order to heal from anxious attachment is to learn to better regulate your nervous system. Again, this has to do with being present for your current experiences and expanding your body's capacity for stress in the future. So that is the very first thing that I would recommend. And this is because when you are triggered and your body is having a visceral response, it's not something that you are consciously doing. You can become conscious of it, and that's done through learning to be more present in your body and with your feelings, even learning to label that experience. There is another piece of advice that I would offer, and this is a lot of the work that I do with clients too, is realizing that at any given time, we are all trying to balance a sense of self or a sense of independence and our relationships or a sense of dependence or interdependence. As anxious attachers, we become so dependent that we become codependent. We lose ourselves. You know, we're not that confident person anymore. A big part of this has to do with the enmeshment seeking that is driven by the traumatic experiences that we've been through. Again, the reactions that we have viscerally in our body. So many people will try to think their way out of their anxious attachment style. You cannot do this. You can only make a certain amount of progress that way. You have to learn to be more present with your feelings, to validate yourself instead of doing what we as anxious attachers do, which is being self-critical, beating ourselves up, isolating ourselves. So when we meet someone that we like, we stop hanging out with our friends. We stop doing the things that we're interested in. One of the very first signs of falling into a space of codependency is canceling plans to accommodate somebody else's schedule. You cannot do that. Mm-hmm. You cannot stop going to the gym, stop meditating. Anxious attachers are great when they're single and after they've grieved the loss of previous partners, but they're also not being triggered. And in our romantic relationships, that's where we're most vulnerable and therefore where we get the most triggered. Emotionally diversifying is critical. I borrowed this concept from the world of finance. Diversification is an investment strategy for mitigating risk. The same thing is true of your emotional life. You need to learn to diversify away from looking at a romantic relationship as the end all be all. That person is a human being. They have their own hobbies and passions and interests and career and friends and goals and fears. Mm-hmm. They can only accommodate you so much. So you have to also learn to prioritize your own friendships, your own relationship with yourself. That's where the nervous system regulation component comes in as well. And to not stop doing the things that you care about, you have to keep doing them when you're with someone. And also, this is where learning to open up and effectively communicate can also help to heal from an anxious attachment standpoint. Oftentimes we've suffered in silence. The other person has no idea that the things that they're doing might be triggering for us or that one of the big things I encourage my anxious attaching clients to do is to tell the people that they're dating, hey, I like to know, you know, generally when I might see you next. That's important to me. Now, many of my clients are also women. That doesn't mean that you have to take on the burden or be the one leaned in to plan the dates, but you let someone know what works for you and what doesn't. And this is why talking about and setting boundaries from some of the first dates is incredibly empowering for someone with an anxious attachment style. Stop beating yourself up for your sensitivity. Start owning it.
I think most people's, as you put it, sensitivities, I think they're really reasonable. And to set those expectations in those first couple of dates, you know, one of the most popular questions that you might receive on a first or second date is, how are you single? Why are you single, right? Mm-hmm. And listen, we all know the intent of that question, right? We can just look at the positive of the intent, which is like, how is someone as incredible as you single? Let's just pretend for a second that it's a positive question. Then we're just gonna Kellyanne Conway ourselves into the answer, right? So you just look at the positive of that question. And then what I always tell people is like, look, you're gonna take those questions that are kind of weird sometimes. Again, people are dumb. That doesn't mean that they're intentionally trying to hurt you, right? And you're going to pivot the answer as an opportunity to set expectations. You know, so if someone asks me, you know, how is someone like you single? You know, I just haven't met someone who has met the expectations that I have for a strong relationship that has strong communication. And someone's going to say, what does that mean? And you're going to say stuff like, well, you know, when I'm in a relationship, I really like being called every day. I like it when someone sends me funny memes. It tells me that they thought about me that day. I like it when, you know, we go on a date at least once a month, you know, and then a date. And they're like, what's a date? Like, I've added something extra now that's not going to be like, oh, that's a lot. Now it's like, oh, more questions, you know. And this is an opportunity, I think, to set the expectations. And I think when we set the expectations and people meet them, it doesn't create it, like, it lessens the opportunities for, let's say, protest behavior. Right.
Completely agree. Yes.
I think everything you said, though, is I 100% agree with. And in fact, I would even add on, you know, not only setting those expectations, but I think we also have to remind ourselves, just like Chris said, you know, you're not going to stop going to the gym. You're not going to stop going out with your friends, which that's a big deal. You're also, if you have other dates lined up, you're not going to not go on those dates.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Because you're just putting all your eggs in one basket, A. B, you're putting a lot of emotional bandwidth now on this person that all he is, it might be, is just a second or third date. Like, he's nothing. He's not your boyfriend. He's not your girl. You know, they might not be your girlfriend, you know? So I always tell people that if you start dating someone, just remember, and I think this is what also Chris was alluding to, you're a single person and they are a single person, and you've both been living single lives. And what will eventually happen is if you keep dating, maybe 2 months in, you know, those single lives diverge and now you have a coupled life, right?
Yes.
But until that happens, this person might have had previous commitments. Like, maybe they have a boys trip coming up to Atlanta, which would be a very fun place to have a boys trip, I think, you know.
Agreed.
And maybe you have a girls trip, you know, to Greece with me in a couple of months. I do. I have a few girls trips planned.
I love that.
You know, we host, hey, listener, we have a few spots left for Crete. But, you know, like, that's what I'm saying. Like, you have a life. You're allowed to still live that life.
Yes. So, this person should add to your life.
Right.
And that familiarity that you were referencing of kind of making your mind up on the first, anxious attachers are usually doing it on the first, second, third date.
I know it.
This is it. I really like this person. There's nothing wrong with that per se, but also you do not know them.
Right.
You do not know them. You might find them familiar. Do not look for sparks. Do not look for butterflies. Those are oftentimes your nervous system signaling this person is familiar to you. And if they're familiar to you, if you have the relational history that I did, that other anxious attachers do, it's probably because your body intuitively knows they're not going to meet my needs. Right. And the chase begins. Don't chase.
That's tough. That's tough for a lot of people. You know, what's funny is, you know, in my coaching program, I'll play a game like, which Sex and the City character do you think is anxious? And 10 out of 10 times, the first answer out of everybody's mouth is always Charlotte. And I'm like, no, Charlotte is secure. She's just neurotic. There is a place where someone can be neurotic and secure.
Yeah.
Because when you look at Charlotte, at all of her plot lines include her being hyper communicative, flexible in relationships. Mm-hmm. Like, she does not initiate conflict.
Boundaried.
She's full boundaries, right? And I feel like, I'm like, you're mixing up these two an adjective with like a mindset. And I think that, you know, it's always good to keep in mind that, you know, there is a place where you could be type A, or you could be neurotic, or you could be someone who, you know, is setting boundaries with people. That doesn't necessarily mean that you're anxious. It means that, I mean, even you can be anxious, but if you look at people like Carrie and you think, I know these are fictional characters,
right?
But they did influence an entire generation of people on how to date,
right?
For better or worse.
Agreed.
Right. So I always think, like, there's a place where you can have certain traits and you're a Charlotte and not necessarily a Carrie.
And also, attachment styles are not fixed.
Yeah.
And
you can jump.
It's important to look at it as a spectrum, mm-hmm. from insecure to secure. No one is 100% anxious and no one is 100% secure.
Yeah.
I used to consider myself about 75% anxious, 25% secure. Now that's flipped for me based on the work that I've done.
That's amazing.
With myself and with my clients. That's a lot. So now I consider myself about 75% secure, about 25% anxious.
Chris, you should be really proud of yourself.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's incredible.
That's why I'm doing what I'm doing. I don't want other people to suffer in the same ways that I did. And to the listener that asked that question, if you need more accountability to change the nature of your relationship with your body and your nervous system, to be better boundaried in your dating, to own and honor who you are, go and find the support that you need to grow more secure. We don't heal in isolation. Yeah. We're social creatures.
Yeah.
We need safe relationships. If you're wounded in unsafe relationships, relationships where someone doesn't appreciate you for who you are and doesn't hear you out and doesn't seem to really care or be consistent about checking in about your feelings, then you have to go and seek out the security and the safety that you haven't experienced to, as we were talking about earlier, rewire your brain. The safer your connections are, and this is where emotional diversification comes in too, the safer your connections are, the more secure and solid you're gonna feel in yourself, and the more you rewrite over those insecure patterns from the past.
I love that. That's great. Thank you for calling in.
Thank you so much. I can't wait to read your book.
Thank you. Awesome. Thank you.
Let's go to our next question. Welcome to the Ask a Matchmaker Hotline. How can we help you?
Hi, Chris. Hi, Matchmaker Maria. So I am finally, honestly, for the first time in my life, in a really good relationship with such an emotionally intelligent man. We've been dating for 10 months, but I find myself overthinking a lot, especially when we aren't together. So two parts here. One you kind of just touched on, but like when we aren't together, I really miss him and I really just want to be around him. You know, I work full time. I have a really good job. I have friends. I have hobbies. So I don't have time for my life to just revolve around him. But I find myself prioritizing his schedule when he's available over mine. And even like how do I feel confident prioritizing myself and doing the things I care about, even when he's around, like my nighttime routine? When he's around, I just kind of like skip my skincare routine, and I don't want to do that. And then second, more with the overthinking, I'm almost like catastrophizing little things that bug me almost to get ahead of it. Like if I can break up with him, then he can't break up with me. But that's not what I want. And that's certainly not what he's communicated at all. So how do I stop doing this in my own head? I'm getting in my own way.
How often do you see him?
I would say right now, 2 to 3 times a week.
That's great. That's a lot. Can I ask, maybe you mentioned it before, but how old are you?
I'm 33 and he is 36.
Okay. How long you've been dating for less than a year?
10 months.
Yes, 10 months.
Have you talked about your future? Like what you see the next 5 years playing out?
We have. So our plan is in the summer of next year. So we'll have been dating 2 years then to move in together and then also get engaged next year. So we have had very serious future looking conversations.
Do you want kids?
I don't know. And I've told him that.
Does he want kids?
He also doesn't know.
Wow. It's so rare to meet two don't knows.
I know.
At least in my world. But so if you follow me online, you know that you get the ring before you move in.
Yes. I told him that too.
I just don't. I don't.
I'm fine with that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to protect the straights. Because there's a lot of time thieving straight men. They will push an engagement out because they're like, well, we moved in. I don't need to get engaged. And I'm like, okay. But then he's like taking away all of your 30s.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
And we're he's not paying for your fertility treatments.
Correct.
So what the fuck? I have one more question for you. In your relationship, in all of your past relationships, are you the planner or the planny?
I am the planner.
I see. Okay. All right. So Chris, I don't know if you know this about me, but I believe that in every relationship, there's a planner and a planny.
Sure.
Sure. And a lot of women sometimes get upset, at least in my DMs. They'll say, how do I get over it? He doesn't want to plan anything. He's not, you know, he's not, you know, does it mean he's not serious about me if he doesn't plan? And I feel like, I think in a lot of couples, you have a planner and a plannee. And if you happen to be the planner, that's okay. And the moment you accept that you're the planner, your life will become infinitely easier. Because when that happens, I've noticed as a planner myself, and every time I dated a planner, I hated their plans. We would get into big fights, like blowout fights, especially on vacation. And the moment I was able to acknowledge, like, you know what? I'm the planner. Like, I want to go my way. My relationships became smooth, right? I'm not saying that my husband is a pushover. No, no, no. But what I am saying, though, is that whenever we go on a vacation or whenever we go on a date or we're going away for a weekend or whatever, I always ask my partner, hey, what are, depending on how many days it's going to be, what is one or two things you hope definitely happens on this trip or at this event? And then, you know, my husband or my previous partners would share, you know, I really hope to go to this excursion, or I really hope to try out this restaurant. Great. And then I will add those hopes into the itinerary that I plan for us as a couple.
Great.
So the reason why I asked this question is because what I'm hearing from the caller is that she is not making time for herself. She's not doing her nighttime routines. It's always his way, his way, his way. I don't know if he's even acknowledging or if he even knows that it's going kind of like his way under, it's going around his schedule. But she's also the planner in that relationship. So it's like she hasn't taken control over what would normally be her in the driving seat.
Fair. Yeah, I agree.
What do you think about all this?
Well, anxious attachers tend to be planners because by nature we're leaned in to our relationships. We tend to maybe even a lot of times overmanage.
Yeah, over-engineer
relationships.
It.
So again, there is some growth to be had in leaning a bit out and trying to find a bit more balance.
Yeah.
So I hear you about the planner versus plannee. And I do think in a lot of instances you have someone that can play one of those roles. Yeah. For me, I think the clearer it is about the role that each of you are playing, the more that you can co-create together, and somebody steps up and plans something occasionally, or the other person will just acknowledge, my partner's the planner. I know they're going to do that. But to me, what I took away from the caller's discussion of her relationship is a couple of things. One, don't stop doing your nighttime routine. There's really no reason for that kind of behavior. Make sure that you continue doing the stuff that makes you feel connected to yourself and to your body. It's a really small thing, but those things add up. And you can see a little bit of the enmeshment seeking that defines the anxious attachment style there, where
it also sets the expectation that this is me time. Like after I wash my face lately, I've been putting on my LED mask and just laying next to my husband with, people on my stories have seen it, this white mask with a red light.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't know if it does anything, but what it does tell my husband, you know, for the next 20 minutes, I'll be watching Law & Order SVU. This mask will be on next 30 minutes. And then after that, I'm going to start putting on my potions. It's going to smell. I have
serums
all of,
and everything.
Yeah, I have all my, you know, I have all my night stuff on my nightstand.
Oh.
Because, yeah, after you wash your face, you don't need to be in your bathroom.
Okay, fair.
And I'll, like, because, you know, I spoke to, so I was at an event. I don't know if you know Codes, the skin brand. It's like one of my favorite skincare routines. And the co-founder, I was with her a couple weeks ago, and she said, I asked her, like, how do you do your stuff? And she said, there's 5 minutes between each thing. Yeah. How many minutes have you been doing? Because I've just been serum and then immediately, right? Like, and I was like, I've been doing it wrong. Yeah, like I was like, oh, it's dry. Like, and she's like, no, like 5 minutes. Like you need your skin to absorb. Like first you put the serum, then you put the oil, then you put the, yeah, right now. Yeah, that's changed my life.
Wow.
So that's when I moved all, like in the last 2 weeks, I've moved my entire nighttime routine to my nightstand.
I'm going to give that a shot. Also, the proximity helps, like being able to see it.
Oh, yeah.
But so... don't stop doing those things, even the small stuff like your nighttime routine. That's where it starts. where you start prioritizing somebody else's needs ahead of your own and becoming codependent. The other thing is there seems to be so much good in your connection. Like you're telling us that you're talking seriously about the future. You have clarity around a proposal and moving in together.
That's amazing.
And you're spending 2 to 3 nights a week together. And this is something that anxious attachers need to know. We struggle with what's called emotional permanence.
What's that?
Emotional permanence is related to object permanence. And object permanence develops at a pretty young age. This is like peekaboo type stuff. Mm-hmm. That when you're behind your hands, I know that you're still there. Mm-hmm. Obviously, a child at a certain age does not know that. They don't have object permanence yet. They literally think you've disappeared.
Right.
When this quality develops in the brain, a subsequent quality develops based on the presence of safe connections growing up with caregivers, theoretically, or parents. Emotional permanence means when that person is not physically present, I know that their feelings have not shifted. And that is what many anxious attachers struggle with. That's literally what you were saying. You get in your head, you're overthinking, you're catastrophizing when you're not together, even though you're spending about half of the nights each week together. In order to build emotional permanence, you have to remind yourself of the good. Call this a practice in gratitude. Call it just a rote repetition of what's going well in the relationship. I have my clients literally make a running list of all of the good in their relationship, because as anxious attachers, we're so quick to criticism. We're so quick to fixation on what needs fixing in the connection, mm-hmm. or what is lacking or what we're not getting, that we completely lose sight of how our partner is showing up, what they are doing for us, all of the wonderful ways in which they are meeting our needs or showing us that they care about us. Literally make a list. I tell my clients all the time, if you're going to keep score, which is what you're doing, you need to keep an accurate score. Fine. Notice all the stuff that isn't working in your mind, and you know, you can figure out how to address that. There also seems to be a communication issue here where you're not really fully expressing to this person that you're seeing your needs and how you are feeling about some of this stuff. I know it can be challenging to open up, but I guarantee you with a conversation, seems like this person would be open to and willing to hear you out. They seem pretty stable, safe, consistent. So realize building emotional permanence, it takes a little time, but it's more about the repetition. Literally create a photo album of screenshots of messages that they send you. Put images and videos from your date nights or from your travels together. And remind yourself of it when you're feeling triggered or when you're missing them. It's okay to miss that person.
Yeah.
Also, final thing, always speak in the direction of what you want more of. Declare what you desire. Declare what you desire. If you want to spend one more night a week together a month, or if you want to spend a night together a month additional over what you have, or you're feeling like you want a little bit more connection, talk to him about what that would look like for the two of you. Relationships are an ongoing conversation and a negotiation.
Right.
If you are feeling disconnected, you need to do the work to address those feelings for yourself by building emotional permanence. And you need to talk to him about ways that you can help to address that feeling. And it might just be him acknowledging that you're even feeling that way.
I love that. I love that. Thank you, Chris. That's such a great answer.
Thank you.
Thank you both so much.
Absolutely. I appreciate it. Welcome to the Ask a Matchmaker Hotline. How can we help you?
Hello. I have another question. Earlier on, Chris, you mentioned the importance of maintaining your own hobbies and passions outside of dating. And that's something I feel really good about having done. And also balancing my passions with my full-time job and dating. And Maria, you suggested, you know, not putting all your eggs in one basket, dating more than one person at once, but there's only so much time in a week. So if I want to make sure that I'm maintaining that time for my passion projects outside of my job, dating, and also making sure that I'm maintaining my friendships, what if you only have time to really date one person at a time?
I mean, when I said don't put all of your eggs in one basket, I'm saying like, don't cancel other dates that you already have planned. If you're the kind of person who only dates one guy at a time, be the person who only dates one guy at a time or one person at a time. I apologize for making it so heteronormative. But what I would say though, is that I think if you are dating and you have a goal in dating, you have to treat it, this is my own take, but you have to treat it like a part-time job. And that means 2 nights a week need to be blocked out. You could still do all of your hobbies and maybe you can integrate those hobbies in those 2 nights. Like for instance, you know, maybe you've always wanted to join a local choir, like you want to learn how to sing, or maybe you want to do a creative writing class. These are still opportunities to meet people. These are opportunities to make friends in that group, build a friendship with a person that you might be interested in. And maybe, mm-hmm. you know, after that event, something like there's a way to participate in hobbies while dating.
I always advise my clients to date more than one person at a time.
Okay.
And that's because as anxious attachers, we overinvest very quickly in one person.
You do put the eggs in the basket.
Yes, it is a thing. Anxious attachers do that. So in order to bring the focus back to yourself and to also have enough data to decide who feels most aligned values-wise, mm-hmm. safety and security-wise, dating more than one person can really help with that and not diving in too quickly and not becoming codependent. I have worked with many clients who have set up pretty firm boundaries for themselves around dating.
Okay.
Where a lot of women will say, like, I'm not going to have more than one drink an hour, and I'm not going to stay for longer than two hours on the date. So that can help to accommodate as well, maybe another date a week, and also not giving up your hobbies, trying to fit it all in. But I always say context is everything. If you don't feel you have the time, that is okay. But also you might want to ask yourself, is this really my priority right now? I do agree that we make the time for the things that matter to us. And it is usually beneficial for an anxious attacher to date more than one person at a time, or at least talk to them. Talk to multiple people. Explore your options. Do not make up your mind too quickly about someone from a dating standpoint. These are all just safeguards from growing codependent. So I'm happy to hear that, you know, you have your hobbies and your passions and your interests and that you're
maybe
not sacrificing
that. You can go
that.
On dates though. Like there's a place where you can go on a date before you go to your hobby. Like let's say you have an event happening at 7 p.m. I mean, you could show up at 7:15, but like go on a date at 6, go on a like nearby down the street, you know, like, hey, you know, like there is a way to, I think, balance both. You know, as you're speaking, Chris, it's making me think of when I met my husband, I actually had gone on a first date with someone else a few days before and we had planned a second date for the week after. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I mean, it was a perfectly good first date. I didn't know if we had long-term compatibility, but I also don't believe that's the purpose of a first date. I believe the purpose of a first date is just to go on a second date. So I was like, you know, he asked me and I was like, fuck yeah, let's go. Mm-hmm. But then I met my husband that weekend. I didn't know he was gonna be my husband, but I met a guy and he was really interesting and cool and I was super curious about him. And we went on, like, you know, I met him through friends and, you know, we went on a couple dates that weekend. And then, you know, I 3 days later, I have another date set up with this other guy. And
did you keep it?
Of course I kept it. Cause I knew then that if I cancel this, now I'm putting a lot of pressure on this one guy that I don't even, I mean, I know him through friends, but I've only been on two dates with him. Like I don't know him.
Right.
And going on that date, you know, this actually has landed in my book. Going on that date changed my life because this guy was cute, perfectly great, good career, like really smart. Like I think he has everything I'm looking for, you know, on paper. And he's very similar to my husband, you know, someone who likes to volunteer. He's a feminist, you know, has strong convictions, progressive, like things that I'm looking for in a person that I want to have kids with. Right. But when we hung out, I just was like, oh no, with the guy I was just on a date with this weekend, that was a connection there. Like I was able to judge like in a very different level who was a better fit for me. Mm-hmm. And I think I get these questions from women sometimes it's never from a man. It's always from women where it's like, I'm dating two guys. Which one do I choose? And in my mind, it's like, well, I would, if you're asking me, I would choose the one that you feel like emotionally compatible with. And I know that can be really tough with only a couple of dates, but ultimately, who do you think you can have a bad day with? And they're going to listen. They're not going to necessarily solve your problem. You know, if you're having a bad day, you're not looking for someone to solve the problem. You're just looking for someone to listen.
Right.
Who's going to listen? You know?
Great point.
So that's what ended up happening. I loved that it was a good second date. I knew within 5 minutes, I was like, oh, there's not going to be a third date with this guy. Mm-hmm. But I also, that was for me was like, oh, another brick, you know, on the house of George. That's my husband's name. And, you know, that's, that kind of redirected me to be like, okay, I got to concentrate on this guy.
Yeah, fair. I think there's nothing wrong with that. When you know, you know.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and then
you just keep, you can experience guilt to validate,
by continuing to date people that you don't really feel truly aligned with.
Yeah, yeah.
You knew. So when you knew, you ended it. I think that's fair.
And I love that I had that second date. I love that I had like another person to be like, okay, this is a good measuring stick. Thank you so much. You know. This person, by the way, like, you know.
But what if you hadn't had that other person in the mix? And I think that's the whole point of what we're talking about.
I would have like
that gives you the contextual data that you need in order to say.
And you said that before, too.
To say, like, I feel more aligned with this person.
Yeah.
If you hadn't had that, there might have been a bit more confusion.
Yeah. No, I think I don't know if my husband and I would have kept dating if I didn't have that measuring stick. Like that context of, you know. Oh, yeah, I should. This was different.
Yep.
You know, because I think when you just date 1% at a time, everyone's different. Oh, I had a good connection. Everyone's different. But now I had like two and they were both perfectly great candidates. Who do I like? Who do I feel like I'm connecting with more?
Right.
And
I noticed what you said, though. Who do I feel? It's a feeling. It's not cognitive.
No,
it's not cognitive always. You're not just checking things off.
Yeah. It was not a matter of a pros and cons list.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
Like, who can I be myself with? And I just remember thinking, like, I can be myself with this guy.
And that be myselfness is safety. That's what it means. Who did you feel safer with? You felt safer with your now husband.
Yeah.
So that is also a good tip for folks that are listening too.
Yeah.
Is to keep in mind that, you know, you need to always check in with yourself around who you feel safest with, who you can open up and have an uncomfortable conversation with, or tell them, hey, I, you know, when I didn't hear from you, it made me feel a certain way. And I'm the kind of person who likes blank in a relationship.
Yeah. I love that.
Stand up for yourself.
Stand up for yourself.
With people that you feel safe with.
Yes, with people that you feel safe with. But also like acknowledge that usually most of the things that people are asking for are insanely reasonable.
And what make a relationship work. Yes, communication. There's no such thing as over communicating.
Any person running for the hills because you said, I want to talk to you every day.
Let them run.
Yeah. Thank you. Don't even chase. Be like, okay. Because
now you know. Now you know it wouldn't
imagine
have worked.
Having kids with that person.
Oh, God. No,
like, that's
I don't want to.
Tough. But that's, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's what I'm talking about. Chris, this has been enlightening. I am so happy to have had you here today. I'm sure we're going to call you back in the future because this was so great.
Thank you.
Everyone who is listening to this or watching this on YouTube, if you loved Chris and you're on YouTube, please comment. Let us know. And if you're following along, head on over to Instagram and follow Chris. He is at Crack Life with 2 F's, CrackLife. I'll include not only the links to his social media in the show notes, but I'm also going to include a link to his website and your book.
Great.
So this way people can purchase your book and learn more about you if they want to seek your services.
Love it. Thank you so much, Maria.
Thank you so much, Chris. And thank you, dear listener. As I said, head on over to YouTube, watch, like, subscribe. Or, of course, if you're listening to this, send it to a few friends. Send it to that friend who just asked you, who just texted you, hey, I haven't heard from him in 6 hours. Do you think he hates me? Send that person a link to this show. I know they're going to, like, really get a lot from this episode. Of course, you know how I end each and every single episode. Be lovable, but more importantly, be likable. See you next week.